The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thank you for listening.
This is from Master Dogen's 300 Koan Shobo Genzo. Case 227, the main case. Shijian Fayan of Lushan was asked by a government officer, "When I took the city of Jinling with an army troop, I killed countless people. Am I at fault?" Shijian said, "I am watching closely." Daroshi's commentary. Priest Zhijian's response, "I am watching closely," is at once fat-headed and misguided. He's missed an opportunity to cause an evil that has already arisen to be extinguished, and to cause good that has not yet arisen to arise. Both he and the general deserve 30 blows of my stick. Governments and rulers are traditionally driven by power, politics, and money, and are not usually inclined towards clear moral commitments. However, for a Zen priest to avoid taking moral responsibility when asked is inexcusable. Enlightenment without morality is not yet enlightenment. Morality without enlightenment is not yet morality. Enlightenment and morality are non-dual in the way. One does not exist without the other. The truth is not beyond good and evil, as is commonly believed. It is rather a way of living one's life with a definite moral commitment that is practiced, realized, and verified within the realm of good and evil itself, and yet remains undefiled by them. Setting aside imposter priests and phony followers, you tell me, how do you transform watching into doing, the three poisons into the three virtues? More importantly, what is it that you call yourself? His poem. Utterly devoid of abilities, the guide can't lead. Lost in self-deception, the evil one can't find his way. Take off the blinders and set down the pack and see. Beyond God masks and devil masks, there is a way. Oh, good morning. We're completing a weekend's retreat on the precepts, the moral teachings of the Buddha, and so I thought this was a good koan to take up. I remember when Dada Roshi was working through these 300 koans. These are a collection of koans that Dogen Zenji brought back from China when he was traveling there, and that he brought back with him and used many of in as teachings within his Shobo Genzo, his masterwork. I don't believe he ever used this one, and I remember Dada Roshi saying, because his working on those koans, 300 of them, took quite a number of years. And he talked towards the end of that about how that the latter group of koans that he was getting to were the ones that he'd been avoiding. He didn't like them. He didn't think they were very good. And as a koan, this is not a very good koan, as koans are meant to be. As a teaching, it's okay. And I remember when Dado gave the talk, he was kind of annoyed with the whole thing. He was annoyed with the dialogue. He was annoyed with the government officer. He was annoyed with the priest. Sort of get that through his commentary. But he uses it well, I think, and makes a very important point. And you know, this was taking place a number of years ago, his teaching on this. In the earlier times of Buddhism, years of Buddhism having come to the West, perhaps particularly in the Zen tradition, there was a fair amount of misunderstanding, as there always has been traditionally, historically, about emptiness and about the nature of emptiness with regards to good and evil. And that somehow by realizing the absolute, you entered a realm that was beyond good and evil, and you don't have to worry about it anymore. It's sort of doesn't touch you anymore, which is not a Buddhist teaching and is a very dangerous notion. It has nothing to do with emptiness or Dharma. And so I think that's part of why he really brought that out in his commentary. The truth is not beyond good and evil, as is commonly believed. And so he says there is a clear moral commitment. There is a way. Living the Buddha way. So there's so many ways of speaking about this. The Buddhism itself, the Dharma, speaks about this. Yesterday we spoke about the three forms of training, the sila, the precepts themselves, sort of cleaning up our house. Samadhi, developing our concentration within mindfulness, deepening into deep states of samadhi and concentration, and prajna, wisdom, that which ultimately transforms our false views. It's also spoken of often in terms of ceasing from harm and practicing all that is good and studying your mind and realizing Buddha mind. In our four vows, we express it as saving all sentient beings, liberating all desires, mastering the dharmas, attaining the way. And all of these ways are different, sort of give us different perspectives, bring us to different practices, touch us in different ways. Which in a sense all comes back to the question of how do you wield the power of your mind? How do you wield the enormous power of your thoughts, your words, and your actions, which are more powerful than we really know and understand? How do you work with your intentions? Do we understand how important intention is in the human realm? In both in delusion and in the Buddha way. Do we understand karma? Do we actually understand how things work, how they move, how one thing affects another? And so all of this is the work, the inner work of Buddhist practice. We all enter this mountain gate with a history, right? We bring the whole of it with us because the history is never about another time. It's about right now, what's happening in your mind, in my mind, and how that influences us in what we do and how we actually hear a sound, in what we actually see when our eyes turn upon an object. Do we actually see what's in front of us? Or do we see our mind's projection? Buddhism says we see a semblance of what's in front of us. We hear a semblance, a likeness of the sound. But in an instant, before we know it, before we can observe it happening, our mind infiltrates that object, that sensation, and infuses it with our own everything. And because we don't see that happening, we misunderstand that those projections, those ideas, that karmic history is in the object itself, and then we act. The Buddha, I quoted this passage from the Buddha's teaching yesterday, in which he said, "For one who is virtuous, non-remorse will arise. For one who is free of remorse, gladness, sympathetic joy will arise, and this leads to joy. And now your body will be serene and you will experience happiness naturally. Your mind becomes concentrated." And that it's a natural law for Buddhists, for non-Buddhists, that for one with a concentrated mind, you will know and see things as they really are. And so as I said yesterday, he makes a very direct connection between what we're doing with our thoughts, words, and actions, with the karma we're creating, the way we're living our lives. It is a way of living one's life with a definite moral commitment, Dharoshi said. So the Buddha makes a very clear connection between that and regret, our ability to be enriched and enlivened and made joyful by the goodness of other people, the good fortune of other people, or whether we feel envious and jealous. whether we can have joy in our lives, whether we will experience happiness at a deep level, and whether, very importantly, our mind will be able to assume its natural state of concentration. We practice in meditation our meditation. We practice mindfulness. We practice concentration. And because it's so difficult in the beginning and for years, depending on how we practice, to bring forth that concentration, it often doesn't feel like a natural state of our mind. Distractedness feels more natural. Like if you don't do anything, right, that's what happens. But concentration is actually our natural state of mind. And with that, the Buddha says, it's a natural law that that will naturally lead towards our ability to see and know things as they are. The Lankavatara says that a mind of suchness, which is the mind that sees and realizes things as they are, the mind of suchness is the mind set free, finally. Virtue is living within the way, is living, manifesting the precepts, is not harming and practicing good. And the sort of the doors of virtue in Buddhism are taught as the precepts, the moral teachings, to live a moral life. The Buddha said the human realm is a profoundly moral world because everything we do has influence, has impact. And those impacts predominantly are either beneficial or harmful. In other words, they're affecting everything and people. And so the Buddha said we live in an inescapably moral universe. And so the sila, the precepts, are one of the doors of virtue, of living a virtuous life. Meditation is one of the other pillars, and generosity, the practice of being generous, of opening our hearts, of being magnanimous. The Buddha said, when a wise person established in virtue develops consciousness, develops their mind and understanding, then as a practitioner, ardent and sagacious, they succeed in disentangling this tangle. Isn't that what brings us to practice? We want to disentangle this tangle. Buddhaghosa, in his masterwork, said virtue at the beginning of the path is important because it brings about the special qualities of non-remorse. You know, so why this emphasis on non-remorse? Well, we all know what it is to feel regret. And the deeper the regret, the greater the burden of that, right? Regret is a very, very difficult thing to hold. Right? It's like there's a moral collision, crisis that happens within us where there's something that has been done and we know that in some fundamental way this goes against something that we should not go against. And thus, so there's a kind of crisis that takes an emotional, affective presence within our body. And that's why the Buddha said that regret is a guardian. It's calling to your attention and say, hey, pay attention here. And so Buddhaghosa says virtue in the beginning is important because it helps us to live without regret. Concentration is important in the middle of the path because it helps to bring about the special qualities of supernormal power. So your superpower in Buddhism is your awareness. Buddha spoke of it as Bodhidharma spoke of it as miraculous awareness. And of course, with our, you know, sort of fantastical making mind, we turn that into all kind of magic tricks. But Buddhism is speaking about something much, much more powerful, much more important, much more interesting, actually. And then wisdom is good in the end because it brings about equanimity with respect to the desire, that which is desired and that which is not desired. So here, this teacher, and Xi Jian, interestingly, I couldn't find out much about him, but he was a student of Fayan, who was a very sort of luminous teacher in Chan, in Chinese Zen, Chinese Buddhism. and who had many disciples. And so it's kind of interesting as to what's going on here. You know, to have studied with Phaon, it's hard to believe that he would have not had more capacity in this response here. So, but this is what we have to work with. So he was a 9th, 10th century master. And so here he's asked this question by this government officer who says, when I took the city of Jingling with an army of troops, I killed countless people. And the footnote says, Daroshi's footnote says, to kill and destroy is easy. To affirm life and nourish is difficult. We talked a little bit yesterday morning about why is that so, right? I mean, every biological being tries to avoid pain and suffering and tries to move towards what's pleasing and affirming. And as Shantideva said, despite the fact that I want to put an end to my suffering, I return again and again and again to the causes of my suffering. I recreate the causes of it. To kill and destroy is easy. And so we see how we have, over the centuries, poured so much of our brilliance, our genius, our creativity, our resources into just that, killing and destroying. The very idea, nobody questions the Department of War, but the idea of a Department of Peace is like, what? But this officer is asking. Isn't that interesting? Why? Why is he asking? He could just be living his life. Why is he bringing this question to the teacher? I killed countless people. Am I at fault? Does he not already know? Is it somebody else's responsibility here? Is he seeking absolution? Does he think the priest has the power to do that? Can that come from the outside? Does he have a seed of doubt somewhere inside of him? Is there a conflict going on within his chest? Am I at fault? Shantideva said, all that I possess and use is like the fleeting vision of a dream. It fades into the realm of memory, and fading will never be seen again. And even in the brief course of this present life, so many friends and foes have passed away before me, and because of whom the harms I have done lie before me, unbearable. My regrets. And all the while, the thought never came to my mind that I too am a brief and passing thing. And so through my anger, my greed, my delusion, my biased mind, I've been the cause of many harmful actions. So Shantideva is just giving voice to this very human, universal experience that we all hold in our own way, depending on our own lives, our own conditions and circumstances. Am I at fault? Daroshi's comment says, cause and effect are one. How can you not know? So Buddhism teaches that in the action, we think of them dualistically. We do something and something, do something over here and something happens over here. We bring forth anger within our mind and our body, and we direct it towards somebody else, and somehow we are not affected by that anger. Cause and effect are one. What is Daroshi used to say all the time? Cause and effect are one. What you do and what happens to you are the same. Basic Buddhist teaching. The actor and the action create each other. The action arises from the mind. The mind arises from desire. An intention is given voice, is established, and then is expressed through our words and our actions. But in a sense, that action is already present before the action. It's in the mind. It's in our body. It's in our emotions. In acting, it grows stronger. It becomes broadcast the consequences become more real. And that establishes the ground for the next action. That's why greed breeds greed. Anger breeds anger. Violence breeds violence. It's like in acting, we learn that. And in learning that, we recreate it. And the more we do that, the more natural that becomes. You know, I've often thought when conflict arises between countries, for instance, if there was just a decision, let's just try something different. What if we just decide we're going to take war off the table? What? Let's just experiment. Okay, that's not an option. Now, what do we have? Because as long as that option's there, it's all set up. It's all ready to go. How can we have all that stuff and not use it, right? How can you not have a fancy car and not drive 120 miles an hour? But that takes a lot of courage. That takes a lot of boldness to actually go a way that you haven't gone before, which is exactly the path of the spiritual seeker. And so to live mindfully, compassionately, generously, patiently, which means virtuously, not only does it not breed remorse, but it breeds, it cultivates and strengthens mindfulness and compassion and generosity and patience. Those qualities become easier and easier. And that frees our mind and our body to now dwell, abide within gladness. Now, because we're not so consumed with our own distress and the consequences of that, there's more room, there's more space. We can take in others. We can take in ourselves in ways that we couldn't before. The mind is not so crowded. Time is moving at its correct pace. In a distracted mind, time seems to be moving more quickly, but it's really just been crowded out. Enlightenment without morality is not yet enlightenment. Morality without enlightenment is not yet morality. So Daitaroshi is presenting how these are non-dual. That's why in Buddhism, these three forms of training are so essential. The idea that I can meditate and just concentrate my mind and sort of divorce that from everything else I'm doing, just going on living the life, whatever I'm doing, and just concentrate, and somehow I'm going to get into a state of concentration, and I'm going to realize my self nature, and I'm going to be enlightened, and it's going to be great, and I will gladly tell you about it. Maybe I'll write a book. I'll almost certainly write a book. That's not real. The Buddha said that path is not successful. You will not succeed. And that's why, that's the profound nature of the Eightfold Path. The Buddha was saying, we cannot isolate any piece of it. Because that itself, that idea of isolation is itself a delusion. That is not a real thing. That is not something we actually have the power to do. That's not the way the world's put together. And so he says, the way is a way of living one's life with a definite moral commitment, which means we practice it, we realize it, we verify it. And this is so essential to understand. You know, as I said yesterday, the precepts are not that difficult to understand, just at a basic level. Don't kill, don't steal, don't lie, and so on. But that's not enough, right? I spoke about, you know, we cannot free ourselves of this tangle with our will. We can't free it with knowledge, not even knowledge of the Dharma. It's not sufficient. And so Daitaroshi says we have to actually make a commitment. And that commitment has to be with our whole heart and soul, our whole being. In other words, it's not just a mental thing. I commit to wanting to do this. I commit to believing that I have Buddha nature. I commit to hoping that I am a good person. I commit to raising bodhicitta. That's why bodhicitta has the aspect of adopting, as Shantideva describes it, which is raising the aspiration for enlightenment and to alleviate suffering of others, to liberate others. And then he says, but then there's attending bodhicitta, practicing it, living it, enacting it. That's what Dada Roshi is talking about in terms of commitment. It's not an abstract thing. So it's a commitment to the moral teachings and living them. It's a commitment to the teachings themselves and practicing them, so that we're aligning what we do as practitioners with the Dharma. And we're doing that step by step. That it's a commitment to the Sangha. Right? That it has to matter deeply to me how I affect you. I remember years ago, Joan Chittister was here, a Catholic nun who's written a lot of books. And she said, you know, I travel around a lot because I've written books and, you know, I'm invited like to come here and give talks and so on. And that's all fine. But the most important thing to me, to her, she said, is when I go back to my home community, my convent, are my sisters happy to see me? Do they want me to come back home? She said, that's the most important thing to me, because that's telling me whether my spiritual life is working. And so we practice. And as Dada Roshi says, this has to take place within the realm of good and evil itself. Well, where else is it going to take place? In our lives, in our world, this time, this place, these circumstances, this history that we have, the karma that we possess individually, that we share together. In a sense, that's the field we've been born into. That's the field where we have to work this out to make our lives unified with the way. We may wish for another time and place. You might hope that you were a different person or had a different set of circumstances, and you could very well die wishing for all of those things. Meanwhile, what we've been given is workable. That's what the Buddha, in essence, discovered. Because nothing is fixed. Nothing is set. You have Buddha nature. You've encountered the way, for goodness sake. What more do you need? So, why wait any longer? This government official, in a sense, is standing in a threshold asking this question, sitting in a field of inquiry, of doubt. Why else would he be asking? If he was completely resolved or completely like tuned out off to that, he wouldn't be asking the question. And sometimes we ask that kind of a question from 100 miles away. And sometimes we ask it right on the spot. And so he's asking, but he may not be ready to face the answer. Maybe the teacher, knowing this officer, for instance, knowing his karma, was responding skillfully in that moment in ways that we can't understand. We don't know what happens next, you see. As a koan, is not important. That's all projection and interpretation and imagination. What's important is just what we see. But from that place, standing on that precipice, he really just need to be pushed off. Sometimes we just need that. We just need to be pushed off. It's like the chick in the nest. They got the wings. They're ready to go. But they don't know that yet. And so sometimes the parent has to give them a little nudge. Out you go. Of course, Dada Roshi says this response is fat-headed and misguided. He's missed an opportunity to cause an evil that has already arisen to be extinguished. In other words, the fact that this officer is asking the question means there's a moment of potential here based in this great harm that's been created, and to bring something good forward that doesn't exist yet. Remorse, atonement, taking responsibility. What he says is, I am watching closely. Sometimes when we're in the presence of somebody that we respect and whose opinion of us matters, being watched can help. I mean, it's part of the function of practicing together. Working with a teacher, living with my teacher all those years, it mattered to me that he was watching what he thought. But that only helps provisionally. We can't rely on that too long. It has to come from the inside. We ultimately need to be the one who's watching. And not just watching, but engaging. Because after all, this koan is not about this teacher. It's not about this officer. That's why Dada Roshi says, so you tell me, how do you transform watching into doing, the three poisons into the three virtues? What is it that you call yourself? That's what the koan's about. That's what the teachings are always about. They're never about someone else. And to understand that the precepts, morality, compassion, loving kindness, intention, desire, an action, a word, its consequence, the person who experiences that consequence, all of that arises from the great ocean of emptiness. It has no inherent characteristic, no intrinsic quality, existence, identity. It is not a thing. That's the basis of the precepts. That's the basis of morality, is that it is not fixed, that it is constantly appearing and disappearing. As the Buddha said, that in this moment, because of cause and conditions, there is something that appears before you. It is to be experienced. It is not to be possessed. You cannot possess it. It is not a thing. It is only to be experienced. But in that, he means experienced skillfully, experienced with a clear mind, from within a profound moral basis and understanding, with an intention and a commitment. Because otherwise, having that experience is lost. Its power is lost. It is only to be experienced and released. And so good and evil, greed, anger, and delusion, wisdom and compassion, the Dharma, the Four Noble Truths, emptiness, all of it has no intrinsic existence of its own. The world itself, the Buddha said, is your eyes, your ears, your nose, your tongue, your skin, your mind. Which doesn't mean with our mind we are literally creating the world. It means that we only know there is a world because of mind. Apart from that, the world doesn't exist. There is no one. You can't hear the cries. You can't respond. You can't experience. And that when that mind that is the world is cloudy, is shrouded, is tangled, that tangle and the world are inseparable. And we don't see that there is any difference. That's the power of delusion. That's why it's so difficult to disentangle the tangle. In a sense, we are completely responsible, and it's not really your fault. Or you could say, it is utterly your fault. And don't take yourself too seriously. But take your delusion rather seriously. And so to move and practice and liberate ourselves and come to life and serve in every way we can within the world of good and evil, and yet remain undefiled. To be undefiled means to not be seduced or fooled or misled. Equanimity, in a sense, you could say, is to be undefiled by the highs and lows, by the opinions, by wrong views and correct views. To not be defiled by our delusion, but also don't be defiled by your enlightenment. Don't be misled by that. Don't make that into something. To not be defiled by our attachments, but also to not be misled by our letting go. In letting go, as we chanted this morning, to not be attached to things is an illusion. To be attached to things is an illusion too, both of them. Because to not be attached to things means you could be, there is something that exists apart from you, but in this moment, you're not attached to it. So both, even though we practice non-attachment, and we practice the precepts, and we take responsibility for karma and the causes, the effects of our actions, because we must, because they are affecting the world, they do have consequence, and those consequences are real in the sense that they are being experienced. And those experiences are affecting people's consciousness, including ours, the actor. And on the basis of those effects and the ways in which our consciousness has changed, that gives rise to new desires and new intentions, which when misled, cause further harmful consequences. And that's what we call samsara. That is the cycle. And so we practice in many ways and for much time in Dharma practice as though all of these things actually do exist. They have a kind of power and we're practicing them skillfully. But within those practices, underneath all of that, is the reality that it's all empty of that very self-existence, that autonomy, that self-power that we experience, seem to experience, that experience that we're having is the mind. That's how powerful the mind is. To create a world in which everything seems inarguably divided. In the Lakavatara Sutra, the Buddha said, it isn't because of attachment to different illusory characteristics that makes things seem illusory. It's because everything is empty of self-existent and vanishes like lightning. That's why it's illusory. It's illusory because it has no self-existence, not because the characteristics we impute or attribute to those flashes of lightning are illusory or seem illusory. That itself is illusory. And so the Buddha went on to say in that sutra, I teach existence. Things do exist. They have a reality. When you are hurt, you are hurt. When you are sad, you are sad. When we say something or do something that hurts someone, we have hurt them. The Buddha says, I teach existence to refute the nihilistic view that nothing exists, so that my disciples will accept samsara, so that they will accept that where they are reborn, this life, involves differences in karma. There are differences. Within ourselves, there are different worlds that have been created, different lives that are being lived right now in this talk. Each of us is in a world that is created by our mind, that is karmic, and we are hearing this talk from within that world. The Buddha is saying we have to understand that and accept that. And so he says, thus I teach existences so that we will accept samsara. If we don't accept it, how can we ever free ourselves of it? If you're in the bottom of a pit and you say, I'm not in the bottom of a pit, what are you talking about? you will be there for as long as you cannot accept that you're in the bottom of a pit. That's not rocket science. To face reality means just that. And just that is a hard thing to do, isn't it? Because when we face that reality, we're facing ourselves. And do I want to be this? Is this who I am? Is this me? No. And yes. If I do not accept that this is the self arising, that this is the consequence of my actions, this regret is the result of something that I have done, then I can't practice it. I will be forever bound to that. And so to face reality is both very simple and very difficult. Also because we are conditioned to avoid discomfort at all costs, which is a very dangerous form of encouragement. And so we practice, we do not deny, we do not ignore, we do not suppress. When something arises, when we say acknowledge it, that's what that means. Face that reality, accept this instant of samsara. It's just a moment of experience. You don't have to possess it, right? Don't identify, but experience it. And at the same time, don't project, don't cling, don't embellish, don't narrate. This is how we learn to accept samsara. And so the Buddha says, I teach existence to refute that tendency to deny by negation or to deny by embellishing it. I don't like this, so I'll turn it into something else. I don't like this, so I'll just disappear it. That's how powerful the mind is. But then the Buddha goes on to say, I teach the illusoriness of self-existence, the emptiness of self-existence, so that we will get free of self-existence. Due to our erroneous views and hopes for a different world, a different time, deluded people are unaware that these are empty, that these only exist because of the perceptions of our own mind. And so to refute the cycle of samsara that this breeds, to prevent deluded people from clinging to erroneous views and hope regarding what belongs to them and others, right? All the ways in which we attribute possessiveness, what belongs to you, your identity, your characteristics, my possessions, my characteristics, to prevent us from that clinging, which is our burden of samsara, I teach the illusory nature of all existence, that it is empty, that it is a dream, a projection of the mind, so that we can see things as they really are, which means to transcend what is nothing but a perception of the mind. Now again, this is not refuting that things have, that exist, right? So there is a gorgeous silver maple tree out in front of the building that I love. We have a long relationship, right? We greet each other every day. I infer that it exists in front of the building right now, because I've seen it so many times. And every time I go out there, there it is. So I infer that it exists. And that's one way that Buddhism recognizes we create the world. And there are valid inferences and there are invalid inferences, right? Sometimes we infer something that isn't true, false projections. But sitting here in this zendo, I don't know that that tree is out there. I don't know that in this moment. That is not a present reality for me in my direct experience. Do you see the difference? That's very important. And so that's really what the Buddha is saying. That when our false perceptions and our false projections create worlds that do not exist, that's the world that we're responding to. That's the world we create karma in. And in that way, we see that non-duality is not an abstract, distant, philosophical concept. It's clearly not abstract for one whose head is on fire, because that fire burning on your head is duality. We don't always recognize it. It's just a fire. It's just hot. It's just burning my head. And in our franticness, we don't really see it. So that's why we have to bring it down a little bit, calm it down a little bit, and learn how to sit as that fire burns so that we can turn towards it and see it more clearly. One thing, all things, move among them and intermingle without distinction, the faith mind says. To live in this realization, you can now be free of anxiety about non-perfection. Non-perfection is just another projection. It's just another idea that we have created to imprison ourselves. And to live in this faith is the road of non-duality. Because non-duality is a trusting mind. It is a mind of faith, a mind that holds the totality in understanding, that knows how to meet this present reality, knows how to just experience this as it is. And so the Buddha said, suchness is a mind set free. Your mind naturally, and my mind naturally. But without practice, it remains distant, or an idea, or a dream, or an aspiration. And so that's why we keep gathering in this hall. That's why we keep returning to this cushion. That's why I was sort of explicit about how we practice mindfulness on Friday night, when you're sitting, and then the bell rings, and then you get up. And now how do you practice it as you're standing up? And now you're standing, waiting for Kenin to begin. And how are you practicing in that moment? And now Kenin has begun. And now how are you practicing in that moment? When you talk through it, it sounds, you know, like, whoa, that's just a whole lot of stuff going on. It's not. It's exactly the opposite. It's so simple. But because our minds are not simple, but because our minds are moving too quickly, right? It seems complicated. And so to cultivate this trusting mind, trusting in Dharma. And when we trust, you know, when you have faith within yourself and you bring forth these virtues, these qualities, these basic qualities, and you leave your house, your apartment, you get off your cushion, you bring that with you, and you bring that to us, right? You bring that to us. Isn't that a good thing to bring? Isn't that a good thing to receive? Isn't it nice when somebody shows up bringing some of those natural qualities? That's how powerful we are.
Thanks so much for listening. To find out more about our ongoing programs and residency opportunities, visit zmm.org.